The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we will be exploring, in a two-hour special, everything from my guest in a half hour from now. He is Dr. Kenneth King, and increasing germ bioweapon research against the Geneva Convention, meaning we're doing it illegally, and the threats it poses to our nation. You have not heard this on any other radio or television program. You will today. And unlike wild conspiracy theorists, we base our research upon quality scholarship. Dr. King holds his doctor from the University of Nebraska, as well as a separate doctor of law from Vanderbilt University. He was also on the faculty of Western Kentucky University, and he's also taught in Missouri and Illinois, and he served with the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. He was also a former attorney for the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund. So when we tell you that there is secret biological weapon research going on in the United States, we can prove it. We can also prove that violates all of our conventions. And I'm going to tie this in to why, for 20 years, the Defense Department, all of the White Houses, Clinton, Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and Obama, have denied that there was ever biological or chemical weapons used in the first Gulf conflict. Oh, yes, there was. The trouble is, we can't acknowledge it because then someone would say, how did it get there? We made it. We sold it to Saddam Hussein, knowing full well he would use it against the Kurds, which he did, and also against the Iranians, which he also did. But as long as he was using them against people we perceived as important then in our struggles, then we did not consider it a crime against humanity, an atrocity. But later, interesting enough, Saddam Hussein was hung because of using those same biological weapons. At no time did our name appear anywhere in the trial. Also today, we will be taking an in-depth look at higher education as a racket. No, I completely dismiss as inaccurate Glenn Beck's statements that our educational system is communist and Marxist. It is not. But we're looking at how kids are paying a fortune for rip-off prestigious education, and underline prestigious. We'll give you the truth about this in a commentary from Washington Monthly by Daniel Loser. We'll also talk about the shadow elite selling out our government, how our government contracting is costing us a fortune. And this is from Huffington Post, Janine Weddle and Linda Kegman. Also, did you know that Seroquel is the deadliest antipsychotic drug ever created? And did you know that it can knock 30 years off your life expectancy? You heard me right. Breaking news that no one has reported exclusively. You'll hear it on this program. Why? Because we actually read the scientific literature. A commentary later, waking up, and by golly, it's 1930. Howie Steiger from Truthdig. Also, commentaries on Monsanto and Gates Clothing, how Bill Gates and his foundation and Monsanto are working together to make the world use genetic engineered seeds. And a special commentary in the second hour, The Age of Mama, by Professor Jim Quinn from Op-Ed News and The Economic Black Hole, Global Research. Two commentaries that are very important because unlike the jump up in the stock market yesterday where everyone says we're rebounding, no, we're not. And I'll explain today in depth why what happens on Wall Street in the stock market index does not directly relate to your lives. So for all of you with an independent and thinking mind who want the facts and the truth so you can make your own decisions about how to respond to it, this is the single most significant radio program for you in the world. Let us go to the information. I'm concerned about over-the-counter medications. The average American, when asked, believes that over-the-counter medications couldn't be that dangerous or you'd have to have a prescription. More and more, you'll hear them say, the most powerful medication without a prescription you can get. People think, well, that's good. It'll help me get over my whatever they're trying to get over. Here is the latest on this and why you should be concerned. This is from Jonathan Benson. Natural News and says, popular over-the-counter medicines so dangerous that only doctors should prescribe them. This is according to the FDA. Now, we know that some popular cough medicines, some pain relievers, could become available by prescription only if an independent panel determines that such action should be taken. Now, the FDA recently issued a report about the dangers of a popular drug ingredient in many non-prescription cough and flu medicines and is considering banning the drug from store shelves. Now, why do I say considering? Excuse me. I'm at a very different altitude than I normally would be, So my voice isn't going to be quite what it normally would be. When we get a preview ahead of anything that's released officially, in comes then the armies of lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry and applies pressure to the people that they know they can count on inside the FDA, especially at the regulatory level, to make sure that, no, we don't want to ban that. No, we don't want doctors to have to prescribe it. Keep it in the products. And so the public never knew that there was a controversy to begin with. Well, according to this report, quote, this additive is, quote, sought after by those seeking to alter their mental state because it exerts psychoactive effects on its users. Though the drug is abused less than codeine, another popular brain-altering drug, this particular drug sent 8,000 people to the emergency room just the year before last. This is twice as many as just a few years ago. And what typically occurs is people buy cough medicines and take many times the recommended dose in order to get high. Did you know that? No, particularly teenagers. They're overdosing on cough medications that can cause an enormous increase in their blood pressure and their heart rate. It can also cause high fevers. And other drugs and cough medicines only exacerbate the problem by bearing heavily upon the liver. So then you end up at 16, 15, 14 with liver disease. So the panel has taken a look, and hundreds of different drugs, including Wyeth's Dimetapp, Bayer's Alka-Seltzer Flu Plus, Procter & Gamble's Vicks cough medicines, all contain the drug in question. So that's where we're at this time. So let's see whether or not they actually ban this. And if they don't, then I will publish and put up on my website the photographs, the backgrounds, the economic interest of each one of the panel members. Yes, I have all the panel members. It's supposed to be a secret panel. Well, it's not to us. After all, after broadcasting for 25 years on WPFW in Washington, D.C., every week, we have a lot of listeners who are very concerned about how special interests have infiltrated and exerted undue pressure and power upon those that the public never knows. Also, I spoke yesterday about the high cost of medications in Canada are bankrupting their system. Well, now today we get another report, and this is from Erasmus University in Rotterdam. And what it did, it took a look at how people who do not have a lot of money, which is tens of millions of people in low and middle income countries, are pushed into the poverty area by buying common but vital medicines, which are already unaffordable to hundreds of millions more. This is the new study. The Dutch researchers, whose work was published in the Public Library of Sciences, a medicine journal, that's a very prestigious journal, it's short for PLOS, on... Well, it was day before yesterday, said their findings show that greater effort is needed to encourage the use of cheaper generic drugs in poorer countries and to ensure more medicines are made available through the public sector. The drugs studied were inhalers used for the management of asthma and also diabetes drugs, which belong to also in a drug class for anyone with insulin problems, and also beta blockers used to treat high blood pressure, and also amoxicillin, which is a broad-based antibiotic. Now, there are times when these drugs are needed and can save a life. But what we're finding is that the drug companies are so greedy and are so immoral that they're willing to exploit their position in the third world and charge people who may only live on a dollar a day to buy branded drugs, which are much higher, instead of the cheaper generic drugs. And that can make the difference of a person being able to afford a drug or not afford a drug. For example, in Nigeria, amoxicillin, which is an antibiotic, is already unaffordable to 56% of the population who live on $1.25 per day. Well, the Nigerians would now be pushed to pay 23% more into poverty by buying a brand name from GlaxoSmithKline. So what you have is you just have a lot of poor people become poor because drug companies are exploiting this. Next up, well, I don't believe anyone should be eating eggs. In any case, you don't need them. We can give you actually higher quality net protein utilization using grains and legumes. But that aside, one of the opening scenes in my new feature film, it won't be out for about 6 months, though. I have other films coming out before this, is How to Become a Healthy Vegetarian. And it'll be coming with a gigantic book, the most definitive book ever written for vegans, with all the science, over 500 references to the actual scientific literature. Every possible aspect of becoming a vegan will be there, including wonderful recipes. Separate, completely aside, I've been asked to do this for a long time, and I finally decided, yes, I will do it, and it's done. I'm going to do a big coffee table size book with nothing but photographs, one per page, of the most outrageous 400 vegan recipes you've ever seen, just so people can see how good a dish can look and how easy it is to make. Anyhow, that'll come out at the same time. But in the film, in one of the scenes, I have a family sitting down to breakfast, and they're getting bacon and eggs and toast and a glass of milk. And that's the children and the teenager, and the mother and father get the same bacon and eggs, toast, with coffee. And then what I do is I simply reverse it in reverse animation to show you how that bacon and eggs and coffee and milk got on that table, clear back to the genetic growth hormone stuck in the cows, how the cows udders extend and stretch and drag the ground, causing infections, mastitis in the teat, and that creates pus, and the pus goes into the milk, and how you can't tell the difference between milk and pus, because every time you drink a glass of milk, there's a high probability you're getting pus, because a glass of milk doesn't come from one cow. It could come from 5,000 cows since the milk is pooled, and there's no way of separating out the pus. So just imagine drinking pimple pus next time you have a glass of milk or some cheese. It's there. But we don't like to see that. We like to think that, you know, that the pork, that's the, whether it's a pork chop or the bacon or Canadian ham, that just appeared out of a refrigerator. It just, in the middle of the night, it materialized, and now it's, gee whiz, it's on our plate, and it smells good and tastes good, and we're used to it, and we like it. No, that came off an animal. Well, let's go back and take a look at the animal and how the animal is raised. So in this one section of the film, this is just one little section of the film, but in this one section of the film, I show this, and it doesn't matter whether the animal is organic or not organic. The same unsanitary conditions frequently exist. Anyhow, here's the latest on this. And this is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture inspection reports have now revealed, if you got a copy of them, that two egg producers implicated in the current egg recall have been running operations conducive to contamination and in clear violation of the law. This, according to Ethan Huth, the reports highlight filthy conditions at both the Wright County Egg and Hillendale Farm Egg Production Facility in Iowa, which include infestations of wild birds, rats, maggots, and massive manure pileups. Now, that I would expect to find if I walked into a back room in the halls of Washington, D.C., in our congressperson's offices. That we could accept, because they live as maggots in manure. But inspectors also observed hens running free outside their cages, tracking manure everywhere, holes in the walls and foundations where other creatures were able to enter, mice running in and out through the facilities, and workers who failed to practice even basic cleanliness and safety protocol. So, gee whiz, they found salmonella in six different samples taken at various facilities, and so why should we be surprised? Quote, here's what it says. We're in the process of analyzing this evidence and considering what enforcement actions would be appropriate. Next up, lowering thyroid activity is linked to longevity. This is interesting. This is from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And they found that the individuals who had a slightly lower thyroid activity and hence lower metabolism live longer than siblings that had normal. So when you start to realize that much of what we do actually speeds up our hormone activity, speeds up our metabolism, like coffee, caffeine, all those energy drinks, then without realizing it, we're putting the body's metabolism at risk of living a shorter life. And finally, for women over menopause, postmenopause, having trouble sleeping, and a lot of them do, good news, estrogen-like compounds found in soy can help postmenopausal women get a better night's sleep. This is according to a study by Dr. Helena Hatchell of the University of São Paulo and published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause. Wasn't a lot. It was 80 milligrams. I suggest about 250 milligrams. But it was a double-blind placebo-controlled, and it went on for a month. And the people who were able to get a better night's sleep, 84%. So that's good news. And that's from soy genistein. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment, taking on a lot of issues. 2-hour special today, and those listening on WMYE, the official radio station of the City of New York. First, we thank the City of New York for allowing us to appear on their radio station. We much appreciate the opportunity to reach all the people. Considering that it's a relatively small signal, even people in my office in 83rd and Broadway can always listen to it, though hopefully that signal will be increasing. We still have had one increase after another in our audience, and so I appreciate the word of mouth getting out there. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Something was brought to my attention. I'm not in New York. I'm way far away filming. But I want to thank Bill Thompson for bringing this to our attention. A lot of websites, evidently, out there are, I was told, up to 20,000 people a day seek out Gary Knoll for information on the Internet. I'm not aware of this. I don't work the Internet. In fact, I don't want anyone sending me any questions because I'm not in a place where I can get that information and return it. So I don't want people thinking that I'm indifferent. It's just that I don't have the access. If you saw my schedule each day, you would appreciate this. In any case, he said that a lot of people say, oh, you know, buy cheap Gary Knoll products. And then you go on there, they're offering outrageous discounts. And only the fact they don't have any of the products, it's a bait and switch. So just be aware that these are not authorized to be selling these products that we have found, especially with green stuff. And so, and then they try to say, oh, we have one just like it. You know, well, no, there is nothing just like it. So just be aware, heads up, all right? Go to GaryKnoll.com, and that way at least you'll be getting the Roe McCoy. A quick commentary, and then back. As many people in this audience know, I am working every day, 7 days a week, around the United States, around the world, to complete filming of some important films, one on children. We have finished Drugging of Our Death by Medicine. It's being edited now. Also on vegetarianism, that one is complete. On the environment, the 12 tipping points. And some other ones that I'm not at liberty to go into because they're of a very sensitive nature. And I don't want anyone finding out what I'm doing and then blocking people from participating. But one of them is about poverty. Poverty USA is just a working title. I don't know what it'll be when I finally bring it out. But it's in two parts. One part is about our homeless vets, 845,000. And you can watch some of those interviews and read the two articles, in-depth articles, on how we've unfortunately treated our vets, either with Gulf War Syndrome or post-traumatic stress disorder. And a lot of people, it's gone viral. We're estimating about 50 million people have read in the articles and watched the videos. It's made a lot of people in the movement aware, and they appreciate that. But then there's the larger issue of just poverty as it is. And I want to share some thoughts from Howie Steyer, because what we're not seeing is we're not seeing the real face of it. I don't see the media out there each day, unfortunately, either on the left or the right in the media. I don't see them talking about and actually showing this. In the year 2010, once again, we're embracing the breadline. Now, you won't see this. That distant, faded, iconic black and white image of the Great Depression, I'm sure many of you have seen that, it's reemerged across America, waiting to be updated fully in the high-definition color. I was just filming this last 2 weeks ago, by the way. Last week in the South Bronx. But now it's all over the world. We're filming in India, showing the new poverty of those who are educated, not the historic poor. We're talking about people with PhDs who are out of work and in food lines. And just as we seldom see pictures of American war dead returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, we seldom see newscasts of the struggling, jobless masses lining up for handouts. But they are lining up. And the scene is not one we are inured to. That of the historic homeless, the permanent underclass being ladled turkey dinners by apron-clad celebrities at Skid Row kitchens at holiday time. No. I'm talking about neatly dressed, solidly middle-class, once-working folk fill their breadlines as they become reconciled to a stark new reality. At the same time, this generation of jobless and the underemployed has yet to embrace what is shaping up to be nothing but the 1930s redux, and their voices murmur inconsistent notes of doubt and disillusionment and hope. Now, they listen daily to banal statistics, consumer indices, home prices, housing starts, unemployment, insurance claims, as we heard today. Oh, gee whiz, isn't it good? There were more people hired in the private environment. Yeah. Compared to how many were unemployed, it's not a good figure. And we hear these intoned by newscasters batting the cycle of adjustives up and down, they say. And, well, yeah, up and down. They hope for no sound reason that these same talking heads that propelled them to invest in stocks and homes that would only appreciate will imminently announce a combination of factors that will dispel this economic morass. It's as if those contentious, post-ironic Shepherd Fairey's hope stickers that remain plastered across the nation continue to radiate hypnotic beams, convincing the viewer that prosperity is just around the corner. Just ask Stuart Barney. And so here are some voices of that doubt, disillusion, and hope, called from a region especially hurting, the city of Los Angeles. Now, if you listen the other morning to my overnight six-hour radio show I do every Wednesday morning from midnight to 6 on the West Coast, from 3 to 9 on the East Coast, you heard a person call in saying, we have people for you to interview the next time you come out. Yep, and I will be out again in the near future, continuing. And this time from Salmar, California. That's a distinct geographically unique area from downtown Los Angeles, as Skid Row as you can get. And yet you're still in Los Angeles County. It's visually to a sea of change from Skid Row's urine-stained concrete pavement. Hard up against the Angels National Forest, the rugged ridgeline of the San Gabriel Mountain spreads majestically from east to west along the horizon. And here on a recent summer afternoon, a breeze with citrus in the air cool down the crowd who sit quietly beneath the shade of a churchyard tree. All's good thus far. But this is no church picnic. There's no frisbee being tossed around, no music being played. No one was prepared for a potato salad to share. They are here to get a box of donated food from the First Baptist Church food pantry, a situation which many of them have only recently become familiarized with, and an overwhelming sense of apprehension prevails among the crowd. There are about 200, akin to that among displaced persons in the aftermath of a building fire. They know this is not the normal order of things and fear the future. A horseman wearing a white straw Stetson trots past astride a palomino and waves lazily, his hat contrasting strongly with his skin, and a scene straight out of Steinbeck is complete. He is brown, Campesino, like the wiry, muscled young men in the work clothes, speaking quietly in Spanish among themselves in the breadline. There are mothers, too, trying to keep their place while they're trying to control their kids who are running all over the place. A thin man with a military posture and GI desert boots and a few sullen and obese colo types sporting shaved heads and the M13 inked into forearms display the allegiance to the Mexican Mafia street gang. There's also a clean-cut man with a pink face. Almost reminds you of a clean-shaven banker. What turns out, he is a banker, a hedge fund funder formerly with Bear Stearns. Matt, 39, lost his last job some 2 years ago. He's soft-spoken. He used to buy and sell companies, and today he has no qualms with the breadline. Quote, there's no stigma attached to this anymore, he says. And also a Navy vet who is simply giving up the idea of getting a job anytime soon. Quote, I'm starting my own business. I take consulting work where I can, and I'm jettisoning my house. Yeah, you can't be self-employed for this Obama mortgage refinancing, so I'm screwed, he says. In the meantime, his unemployment check stopped coming, far short of the 9 weeks that lawmakers babbled about during the recent congressional vote on extending benefits to the long-term unemployed. For the first 5 months, Matt has been joining his 74-year-old father, Frank, a retired L.A. Unified School District teacher who took an unexpected financial hit for weekly trips to the church pantry. Both his father and he are hungry. They don't have money for food. Quote, I feel anxious about money, he says in a measured understatement, as the banker has an insight shared by Wall Streeters, colleagues, and others who remain at work and are overwhelmingly pessimistic. He has also become acquainted with free days at LA museums and free concerts, and he drinks at the Hollywood Legion Hall, where vets get $2.50 cocktails And like others here, Matt doesn't appear to be starving between food giveaways. Quote, you know how a boa constrictor eats a whole goat because it doesn't know when it's going to eat again? No one complains at the necessity of feeding the horse when he's not working, John Steinbeck noted in The Grapes of Wrath, describing the madness of starving people amid the agricultural bounty of California during the Great Depression. This time around, the people are being fed. For now, anyway. We have an increasing demand and a variable supply, and we're not meeting demand right now, says Darren Hoffman, communications director for the LA Regional Food Bank, a warehouse complex in South Central so cavernous a squadron of Black Hawk helicopters could maneuver in it. The food bank is wellspring for more than 575 other food pantries, like that of the Salmar Church throughout LA County. The past 24 months has seen a huge jump in demand. Quote, the food bank distributed 54 million pounds of food, and yet it's not enough. We're running out. 2 years ago, the same food bank distributed 34 million pounds, almost doubling now. Meanwhile, Beverly Hills gears up for a four-day festival of wine and gourmet food, and you got to pay $149 just to get in to sample it. In July of 1932, then-Army Chief of Staff General Douglas MacArthur led armor, cavalry, and infantry against hungry Americans, veterans of the Great War, ending the Bonus Army march on Washington, D.C. at Bayonet Point. Today is doll-like pigeon-stained sculpture stands in his L.A. park, a showpiece of the city long fallen into a hangout for the down and out, where at dawn each day the general again faces ranks of hungry Americans. I just didn't know. I didn't know you had to do this crap for food stamps, a bewildered African-American male in his early 20s grumbles after being handed a shovel by the parks worker. He has arrived at 6 a.m. to put in his hours for the state's workfare program, which demands that able-bodied recipients without children labor to maintain their benefits. But this is a no-shovel-ready job. This is crap. I could be out looking for work, he says, leaning on his shovel. It actually is the make-work that soldiers in the garrison are giving to keep them from fighting each day. The new food stamp recipient is counseled by an older man who has been on welfare the past 2 years. Tell him you're homeless. You sleep on the friend's couch. Then you can get relief. That's $200 a month. Tell him you're aid worker. You deserve a check. The men fan out, flanking the general statue, and as the sun rises higher, they find shade. After a couple of hours, the park worker drives by in a golf cart and explains, when the park is clean, you can go shopping. Go to McDonald's. Just come back in the afternoon to sign out and bring back the vest. Jennifer Williams is 32 and smiles broadly, radiantly energized as she bounces among the shoppers in the Hollywood Women's Boutique, where she works selling the type of gear Jessica Simpson wears on magazine covers, where women who just seem to have money are taking advantage of the store's deep retail discounts. Williams appears to be in her element, offering help or a glass of wine, after all this is Hollywood, to shoppers. But after ringing up the sale, she turns stone cold serious. The smile vanishes. I wake up and I feel like I failed, she says. Williams spent the past 10 years working her way up in the core industry of this creative capital, film production. She's been making 5 a.m. call times, putting in the groundwork that propels a career in production, meeting people and building a reputation for getting things done. She found her niche in production coordinating, producing TV commercials, the first thing to go when the credit dried up. Williams says she feels, quote, like when someone in a relationship cheats on you and you look inward and blame yourself. What did I do? What can I do? Her dream was modest, an accessible one, to be a production manager in the producers union, where she can earn $500 to $750 in a day of shooting. She's day playing for TV, filling spots when someone with a job can't make it, 2 days a week if she's lucky. People who produce commercials for television have a nice life. They can make $20,000 in a few weeks of shooting and go on to the other projects or vacation, she says wistfully. Taking the part-time sales position was the first step to realizing the production work might not come back. I hope things change. I don't want to give up my dream just yet. The 30s was a time when people had very little and there was nothing to hide behind. It was a glorious non-BS time, so wrote Charles Bukowski, the poet, the author who grew up in Los Angeles during the Depression and who was moved by the image of the unemployed men, the fathers of classmates, killing the day sitting on the porches of East Hollywood. Today, in his old neighborhood, he finds the unemployed, mostly young creative types who came to L.A. to work in TV and film, filling the cafes, the ubiquitous shops emblematic of L.A. culture. Noon and you can't find an open table in any of them, but the coffee shop goers don't come here to socialize, to discuss politics or movies, or even to have coffee. These are offices for those without a reason to be in an office, where they sit silently staring at laptop screens, poring over Craigslist job offerings, firing off resumes into cyberspace, pecking away at pipe dream projects, and they are filled with hope and unable to share the poet's sensibility and embrace of a non-BS time. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Noll. We're going to be going to my guests in approximately 8 minutes or so, 10 minutes. But before them, and that's Dr. Kenneth King talking about increasing germ bioweapon research and the threat it poses to the nation. This is an interview you have not heard before. Let's now go in studio and say hello to Kara Lee. Hi, Kara Lee.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Well, Kara Lee, before we go to you, I also see that we have Luann Panessi on the line. So let's go over and say hello to Luann and see what's
going on. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Luann.
Hi. You know, a couple of weeks ago, you must have planted a seed in people's heads because I'm getting an awful lot of emails about this homestead progress thing, this thing that you're doing. But here's what I'm thinking. Not everyone gets to listen to the show every day, even though they can download things. What about if we had, like, a conference call maybe one day next week? Everyone's home from vacation then. And this way you could answer all their questions because I certainly can't answer the questions. They're asking me very, very good questions about homesteading, and you're our expert. So that was one of the things I was thinking about. And secondly, you know, we want to learn about sustainable organic gardening. Now, I've been to your ranch in Texas. I've been to your place in Florida where you have that very unique gardening project that you do, and where people told you you couldn't grow anything, and you're growing things that people never expected. I wonder if there's a way, if people were able to just come down to your place in Florida for a week or maybe a month and learn about, you know, actually this process. How do I do it? What do I do first? What kind of soil? What kind of topsoil? How do I protect from the insects? These are all the questions that people have been coming up with. And this way, and then once you grow everything, how do you harvest it? I mean, I have to tell you, I was down there, and sometimes I can't tell what's a weed and and what's something to harvest. So it would be great if you had an opportunity for people to be able to say, to recognize this and learn all the different plants and how to plant and how to harvest and how long different plants take and natural ways to prevent pests from invading your crops. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, you've asked three questions. The first is, assuming I could get to a place where I could do a conference call, I wouldn't mind spending an hour talking with people around the world who are interested in doing their own homesteading, what's involved around the world, not just the United States, the best places for long-term sustainable environments, including where you're most likely to run into people who have a similar mindset and therefore are able, wherever needed, to share a common interest. I could see doing that. So what we'll do, we'll... I'll let Caroline know where I'm going to be in the next week to 10 days on the road, and we might be able to do that. To the second issue, I believe that no one should do any form of homesteading until they actually experiment to see if it's something they feel good about. A lot of people are not used to getting their hands in the soil, and they don't understand that nature has all kinds of surprises for you. And a lot of people... it's not their nature to be that patient and then to say, gee whiz, it's not growing the way I wanted, or what do I do with it now it's grown? There's more than what I can eat. Where do I sell it? You have to take your time and be patient and realize it takes mastery. And I believe that people shouldn't go out and buy a piece of property before they actually do something. They could do it in a community garden, maybe in their neighborhood, or maybe out in the country. I personally like to be at my home, which I'm not going to be for a while, if anyone's going to be learning gardening. Because at least if there's questions or mistakes, I'll prevent the mistakes and answer the questions, so at least they get that experience. I do have some local farmers who are local. These are real good homesteaders who are more than capable of guiding some people. If maybe one person at a time or a couple maximum wanted to come, I wouldn't mind having a few people down to learn gardening. But it's work. I mean, it's work. It's, you know, my problem is if anyone's been there and if I'm not there, they act like it's a resort. Oh, let's go swimming. Oh, let's go on the track. Oh, let's go to the gym. You know? And then, what, did you plan anything? Oh, we're thinking about it. No, it's, you know, it's got to be, you know, on the ground, planting, working, weeding, it's work. So if someone wants to do that, let them give you a call, and you can screen them, and then maybe one or two people would give a chance to learn. Otherwise, I don't want just anyone thinking, oh, that might be fun, because then you get some nut jobs. All right?
Okay.
So you give your number, and
okay,
you talk with it.
All right, fine. People can call me at 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And I'll see if I can get some people to come down.
Good. Okay. And otherwise, for the conference call that we would do all over the world, about maybe an hour on the future of homesteading and what's really involved, plan that for about 2 weeks from now. All right?
Excellent.
Because I should be at a city where I could do a conference call.
Well, it's exciting to see that people are following through. The fact that they're contacting me, or I don't know if they're emailing you. You said you can't really get to your emails, but I know I'm getting a lot of emails from people that I've counseled, from groups. So I think it's going to be very exciting.
Okay, give you a number.
631-504-6198.
Okay, and just like maybe one or two people, that's it. All right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Bye. Kara Lee, I don't want to give short time to you, but we have a whole nother hour after this. I want to go to our guests, so why don't we reconnect with you and the questions that you have and from our audience who've reached out to you in the next hour, okay?
Sure thing, Gary.
Good. Now let's go over and say hello to Dr. Kenneth King. We'll just give you a brief overview. He holds a doctorate from the University of Nebraska and a doctorate in law separately from Vanderbilt University. And his most recent research and writing has been focused on government-funded research that is increasing and yet remains under the radar into the pathogenic organisms as bioweapons under the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security and the National Bio and Agro Facility Programs. He's written a book called Germs Gone Wild. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. King.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
I'm going to ask you just two basic questions to get started. I've done three major feature films on Gulf War syndrome, and I've been working with the Gulf War vets now for almost 20 years on this. And the very first thing I noticed is that many of the vets who had Gulf War syndrome had very rare and unusual blood chemistries. And when I took a look at their pathology reports, some of them had microorganisms in their body that were not natural to the human body. These were genetically engineered microorganisms. And yet, at no time, with all the legislators, Chris Dodd and all the other senators I've interviewed and went to Washington to film, no one was willing to acknowledge that the United States government actively engaged in creating and researching and deploying weapons of mass destruction, meaning chemical or biological weapons, to Saddam Hussein. Yet we found the invoices, the bills of lading, how through both the CDC and through the Department of Agriculture, we did produce some biological and chemical weapon ingredients that Saddam would later use on the Turks, along with what Britain also sent him, and the Iranians. And one of the things that finally hit me was one of the reasons we had to dismiss all cases of Gulf War syndrome as being non-existent. And that's been the official policy. It just doesn't exist. This is all in your mind. And yet these people have had rare cancers. These people went in their 20s healthy and their bodies were ravaged. As I believe that it was because we would have had to acknowledge that we were in violation of the Geneva Convention and other conventions and treaties by actually overtly and covertly experimenting with and then giving Saddam Hussein these biological weapons, and this would come back to haunt us. Your thoughts on this, please.
All the evidence that I have seen that has come out since 2001 indicated that, I forget the Gulf War syndrome was originally, he did have bioweapons agents back at that particular point in the original Gulf War. And yes, we had had shared some of those with him and everything. I have to say I am aware of Gulf War syndrome, and I think it's an unexplained thing that the government has been eager to cover up. I've seen different possible explanations. One of them is that the anthrax vaccine and some of the other vaccines that the government gives its soldiers may be causing that. So
we share that. We believe it's multifactorial.
Sure, I think it could be. But I haven't researched Gulf War syndrome enough to be able to speak confidently
That
area.
Then let's do this. I think we need to have you tell us about the National Bio and Agro Facility project under the Department of Homeland Security, and what is the mission of this project, and who are the forces behind its creation, and what mandates has it been given thus far, and then provide us with some background into the BSL-3 and the BSL-4 laboratory, and how many are there, and give us this.
We need
the background.
Well, the basic background is that after the anthrax attacks of 2001, which ended up coming from one of our own facilities, according to the FBI, U.S. Emirate at Fort Detrick, there was a huge amount of money thrown into biodefense research for the creation of new facilities involving new researchers in the area. There was something like a sevenfold increase in funding for biodefense research. At that point in 2001, there were something like 200 so-called high-containment BSL-3, BSL-4 labs which study either diseases for which there is no effective cure treatment or diseases for which there is some sort of treatment, but if you don't get the treatment, you're probably going to die. There were about 200 of those in 2001. The Government Accountability Office reported in 2007 that nobody even knew how many there are now, but the number registered with the CDC and USDA was 1,356, so something like a sevenfold increase. I realized in checking that there were only eight times as many Starbucks in the country. There are like 15,000 people now involved in the area. Most of those people had done no work with bioweapons agents prior to 2001. And these facilities are engaged in some really freaky, reckless research. They are largely unmonitored, largely unregulated. The Government Accountability Office testified in 2007 that they were largely self-policing themselves. They have accidents fairly regularly of various kinds. They go to every effort to conceal those from the public because obviously the public will become concerned if they hear about the accidents. The National Bio and Agro Facility is just one of the new BSL-4 facilities that is going up. There were five of those in 2001. There will soon be 15. This particular one was built as a replacement for the Animal Disease Center, which is currently located on Plum Island and has a pretty tawdry history of problems that has concerned New Yorkers, and New Yorkers have kindly sternly resisted any efforts to put a BSL-4 facility on Plum Island, and so it looked like DHS decided it would try to put it elsewhere. The facility is going to be like three times the size of the one at Plum Island. It was advertised by DHS initially as a huge super center for researching human, animal, and zoonotic diseases. After DHS encountered protest at some of the potential sites for this facility, it posted this small, scaled-down diseases of interest list and has routinely denied that it's going to research things like anthrax and Ebola there, even though there were over 350 facilities around the country that research anthrax, and anthrax is a major zoonotic disease. So one can be suspicious about whether they're speaking the truth about what their plans are. The thing that has caused most controversy about their decision is that the foot-and-mouth disease, which has been a primary focus of Plum Island, is, while not dangerous to humans, is devastating to livestock and is highly contagious, can spread on clothing, can spread through the air. The last outbreak of that, which occurred in the U.S., occurred on Plum Island in 78, when animals which were being held outside the lab, outside the containment area, were mysteriously infected with foot-and-mouth disease. They destroyed all the animals on the island. They went to the mainland, scared to death it might have spread there because it could cause the immediate shutdown of American livestock exports and huge economic losses. They never figured out what caused that, but they stopped holding the lab animals outside the lab. Well, the Homeland Security has decided to move this facility now to the edge of Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas, the heart of the country's livestock belt. And when I made my visit out there, I discovered that the current livestock herd is right next to that facility, and that livestock herd is in turn next to the football stadium. So
hold your thoughts, Dr. Kamen, sure, because we're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. You can continue listening to this discussion on GaryNull.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Dr. King, three things just really jump out at me. Why in the world do we need thousands upon thousands of facilities testing something that we have signed treaties banning? Why would we want to be in a position to rejuvenate the flu vaccine of the 19-teens? This makes no sense to me.
Well, I can give you their rationale, which is that some bioterrorist somewhere who's not going to abide by the treaty might somehow get their hands on some dangerous substance and possibly some cave magician out in Afghanistan may create these hugely sophisticated genetically engineered pathogens. and so forth, so that we have to be prepared for any conceivable thing that might happen. And
I don't
unfortunately,
believe that.
We can't.
That to me makes no sense.
No, it makes no sense to me. And why they should bring the 1918 flu back to life. And by the way, when they did that, they published the entire genomic sequence for that in Nature. So if they wanted to do something for bioterrorists, they told them how to do it, you know, how to bring it back to life. And it killed 50 million to 100 million people in 1918. So, yeah, my title, Germs Gone Wild, is deliberate, and it's not deliberately provocative. I think that describes the situation that is existing right now.
Also, I'm concerned that so much of this is done by private contractors, and we already know the game private contractors play.
Oh, absolutely.
They get enormous enrichment. They're not given any oversight of any meaningfulness,
sure,
like Blackwater wasn't. These are almost always politically connected people who go to former generals or legislators or lobbyists, and then suddenly they're making millions of dollars doing work that we as a society don't need. And I have to ask a basic question. When the average American is struggling just to make ends meet, and we are squandering hundreds of billions of dollars on redundancy and nonsense research in the military-industrial complex, and now we find out there's this whole subculture within the military-industrial complex, all these secret labs doing work on biological agents, and yet we don't have money to pay for good education. We don't have money to feed the children in the United States. 12.9 million children go to bed hungry.
Sure, sure, sure.
Something's wrong with this.
Oh, absolutely. And we don't have money for a really good health insurance system either, supposedly. And I talk in my book about the biodefense complex and all the political connections connected with that. But yes, we have a complex consisting of politicians, economic development consortiums, research universities, government agencies, biodefense think tanks, pharmaceutical companies, which are all benefiting from public expenditures in this area and therefore devoted to hyping the bioterrorism threat. And two of the worst offenders are the Graham Talent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has a tight relationship with the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity, which has supplied, unfortunately, an important official in the Obama administration. And I discovered that when the Graham Talent thing issued their report card giving an F to the Obama administration, which, by the way, had just taken the Bush biodefense strategy pretty much straight, carrying forward with it. You know, that involved a sevenfold increase in biodefense funding, but Graham and Talent are saying we need to spend 7 or 8, 10 times more than that even, and so they gave the Obama administration an F. I discovered they got their figures from the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity, which has been hyping this with this thing. Ms. O'Toole, who is the Undersecretary of Science and Technology now, ran these exercises, Dark Winter and Atlantic Storm, that greatly hyped the transmission rates for smallpox and scared all of the people in the government. So we have this whole terror complex, which is keeping the alarm factor up outside any kind of rational proportion.
Share with us in depth. I'd really like you to take your time.
Sure.
Give us your extended answer on this. As you outlined, there's a growing criticism about these bioweapon facilities, but you do not hear that criticism from either the Democrats or Republicans, the talking heads at all these major foundations.
Sure.
The neocons certainly aren't. You're not going to hear anyone criticizing it on Fox or Sean Hannity. So the American public simply is unaware of all this.
Sure.
But what could be some of the possible downsides if this goes bad, considering that there was not supposed to be any downside with British Petroleum's oil rig collapsing in the Gulf? It did. There wasn't supposed to be a downsize with any of the things that end up happening, that a bridge
sure
collapsing. So tell us what's possibility, since there's so many of these facilities now.
Okay, well, let me give some examples. First of all, the scariest thing that has been done to date in these facilities is that just this past year, a team led by a scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison created all the possible crosses between bird flu and H3N2 human flu, all 254 possible crosses. 22 of those crosses are easily transmissible directly between human beings, this sort of bird flu pandemic that there's been all the concern about, and they are more deadly than the original bird flu, which already kills 50% of the people who get it. This work has been done at multiple facilities, not even at the highest level of containment, BSL-4. It's been done at something called BSL-3 Enhanced. The CDC has allowed this to occur. There has been at least one recorded accident at University of Texas Austin where there was a cross like this and the centrifuge broke. So all it requires is one researcher getting infected with this pandemic monster and then walking out into the neighborhood and starting this pandemic that we're so concerned about. And given the fact that we have 15,000 researchers in this area, most of them new to bioweapons agents since 2001, we've got a lot of untrained people coming into the field. We got a lot of largely unmonitored labs. So you have greatly multiplied chances for a serious accident occurring. And so that's the worst thing that could happen. Now, other downsides are that we're spending all this money on bioweapons agents that do not cause people problems under normal circumstances, like maybe 200 people get tularemia or rabbit fever in the country normally in a year, while we're not spending money in our public health infrastructure and such, which is actually what needs to be strong if we were to have a bioterror attack or any kind of serious health crisis. Instead, we're spending all this money, first of all, creating new bioweapons agents because a terrorist might create them so we can see if we can develop a defense against them. And, it's an endless thing of the dog chasing its tail. And so that's the other downside of this.
I see this as no more reasonable than the anti-nuclear proliferation arrangements where we still hold 7,000 nuclear weapons or enough to kill every man, woman, and child on the earth 27 times. And yet other countries now say, well, you have them, we should have them. So then
yes. And that is one of the concerns that has been raised about this expansion is that the way it appears to other countries who may feel that we are, and we are definitely stretching the limits on the treaty that we signed in 72 when we create new agents that did not create before so that we can develop a defense against them. Many people think we are violating the Biological Weapons Convention in doing so. Of course, as you know, during our past administration, we pretty much thumbed our noses at any kind of international law or agreements of all sorts. So this may encourage just one moment. This may encourage other countries to violate the convention as well.
My last question has two parts to it.
Sure.
The first has to deal with, in America, we love to create enormous bureaucracies that become self-perpetuating where we no longer look at what the original meaning was. They're just every year they get the funding. There's no questions about it.
Absolutely.
So now you're talking about politicians, universities, pharmaceutical and vaccine companies, think tanks, all working together. That means that the policymakers within the permanent political class structure has no impediment to going forward and even expanding it more, all the while getting whatever money it wants, no matter what its success or failure is. It's never accountable.
Sure.
Instead of looking at something realistically, everybody has jumped on this bandwagon, just like the bailouts in Wall Street. All the toxic assets that we took back through the Federal Reserve, cleaned them up, and gave them back zero interest money. No one was ever told who got the money, what toxic assets, what the conditions were. Why should we believe any of this is ever going to benefit us?
that's my feeling exactly. My research in this area has greatly increased my distrust of our governmental institutions and what is occurring in our society in general, unfortunately. So, yes, I think you're on the same wavelength as I am in that respect.
But my experience has been that both the left and the right virtually ignore the danger that this kind of research and these institutions ultimately represent. They don't want to touch it. And I'm looking at resistant strains of bacteria and viruses like the MSRA, Staph being one particularly dangerous one that has killed tens of thousands of individuals in the United States.
Sure.
And these germs are already present among us.
That's what we ought to be researching, yes.
And we're not looking at what we have created.
Right, absolutely. And I think the basic reason for it is that the left is afraid of being painted as anti-defense in some way, and so they just buy into this whole thing. But as far as I'm concerned, they almost become the right again. So, you know, why? You know, what's the purpose of being the left if you're just going to be a carbon copy of the right?
And that's all we have today.
Yeah, unfortunately. I agree with that.
Well, Dr. King, thank you very much for coming on and setting us straight and giving us some heads up and insight into this very important matter that is not being discussed in the mainstream media. Germs Gone Wild, How the Unchecked Development of Domestic Biodefense Threatens America, and germsgonewild.com. All the best to you and your efforts.
Okay, thank you very much, Gary.
That's Dr. Kenneth King, and again, he is both holds a doctorate in law from Vanderbilt University and also a PhD from University of Nebraska. He spent a lot of time researching this. He was also with the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Illinois and with the Defense Appalachian Research and Defense Fund. So he brings a lot of scholarship to this topic. Years ago, I wrote a book, Biological Weapons Vaccines, and boy, is that timely now. I had to go back and think about redoing that. Let me just give some of the people in this audience before we go on to our next issues an update. 1942, the War Research Services is secretly constituted to initiate U.S. research into biological warfare. And then 1943, Camp Dietrich becomes a secret headquarters for the Chemical Warfare and Bio Warfare Division. In 1946 to 48, in exchange for their experimental data, the U.S. gives Japanese scientists a free pass on prosecution for war crimes, and the U.S. receives 15,000 slides taken of the corpses of U.S. soldiers that were used as experimental victims by the Japanese. And in 1949 to 69, in secret biowarfare tests, the military blankets 239 populated areas around the United States with bacteria, erroneously asserting it was harmless. It was not. It was carcinogenic. And they did it without our knowledge. And I was the first journalist, by the way, to break that story in any major publication. That was October 15, 1989. I broke that story. Then in November 1953, it was Pandora's Box 1. The CIA officer Sidney Gottlieb spikes the drinks of individuals. And really talk about bad situations. He was spiking the drinks, and a biowarfare researchers. And he did it with LSD. And a few days later, Frank Olson, the chief of Dietrich's Special Operations Division, Plans and Assessments Branch, who had been feeling kind of mixed up and declaring that he wanted out of the germ warfare business, well, suddenly he just decides to jump out of a building or was pushed from a 175-foot hotel window. And then later, the U.S. conducts Project White Coat, infecting 2,200 Seventh-day Adventists with bioweapons agents. And why? Well, because could it have anything to do with the fact that the Seventh-day Adventists were conscientious objectors? And then at Dugway, Utah, an open-air nerve gas test goes astray and kills thousands of sheep. And the Army at first it denies, as it always does, they're pathological liars. They denied that the test happened at all. Then they denied that the test killed the sheep. Well, the test did kill the sheep. And then one of the low-life presidents, oh, gee whiz, how many of those do we have? How about most of them? Richard Nixon orders an end to the U.S. offensive biological weapons research, but do it in secret. Just give, you know, let the people think that it's all done. And then we have the, back in 1978, the first outbreak, official outbreak of foot and mouth disease since 1929, and that occurs on Plum Island. And animals being held outside the containment area for further research are unexpectedly infected with the foot and mouth disease, and only the island location of the outbreak prevents the spread to the mainland and devastating economic consequences. Then after that, an accidental release of anthrax from a Soviet facility kills 64 people. What do the Russians care? The Russians have never cared about how many people die from anything they do. They are just, they're virtually at the same intellectual level as the barbarians that preceded them in their political Marxist communist ideology. You know, anything, any deaths, any suffering, as long as it's not, of course, to the ranking Politburo, or today the oligarchs. Then the Army tries to bury plans to construct a BSL-4 aerosol test facility at Dugway in a routine allocation request. So it tried to hide all this, and that was 1984. Then from 1984 to 1988, the Army plans for the Dugway BSL-4 facility were vigorously opposed by some scientists and doctors. And then in 1988, the Senate subcommittee says the military German chemical warfare needs to be better protected. And then Charles Piller's article in The Nation, Lethal Lies About Fatal Diseases, shows a number of reckless research done at Dugway. And then in 1989, Neil Levitt, a former Dietrich researcher, tells Utah newspaper, this was really something, how the Army had deleted from his reports his concerns about germ contamination and missing samples. And then we had Hurricane Bob shuts down all electrical power at Plum Island for 18 hours. That turned off all the negative air pressure and other protective systems in the biological meltdown. So in effect, just like in one of those zombie movies where the protective vent systems go down and Resident Evil, was that it? I actually happen to like that series. I thought it was a good series. I think a new one's coming out next week. You know, suddenly everyone's affected because the virus is in the air. Well, that actually happened. There was a biological meltdown at Plum Island. Then Dugway resumes testing at its controversial Baker Laboratory, and then Dietrich connects several private residences to city water after carcinogens from Dietrich chemical dump end up in the residents' wells. And then the Army releases the environmental impact statement for a new Dugway germ lab at the Life Sciences facility. And then Ed Hammond and his wife Susan Pimento join with German biologist Jan van Aken to establish U.S. branch of the Sunshine Project. And then Dietrich Research contracts Glandular and continues to work for 6 months while failing to report his symptoms. And then Pandora's Box 2, which is an Australian research team, announces that it was inadvertently engineered a killer mouse pox virus and raised the possibility of modifying the smallpox virus in a similar fashion. And then USDA's efforts to make Plum Island a BSL-4 facility are blocked by the efforts of the New York Congressman Mike Forbes. And then researchers at Plum Island and Dietrich and the CDC evacuate their respective facilities and as over some supposed terrorist attack. And then 22 people are sick and 5 die from the anthrax letter attacks, believed to have originated from within the U.S.'s own biodefense complex, so that person was never caught. And it goes on. I mean, we have Pandora's Box 3 at the University of St. Louis. Scientist Mark Buhler deliberately creates an even deadlier version of mouse pox, one which kills all mice, even if they've been previously vaccinated or treated with antiviral medication. And Buhler modifies the cowpox virus, which affects humans and is also closely related to smallpox in similar fashion. And then research at the University of Washington using the foolproof Madison aerosol chamber, gee whiz, are infected by tuberculosis. Well, it wasn't foolproof. Then the National Institutes of Health announces that it has chosen Boston and Galveston as a site for its two BSL-4 facilities. And then doctors Tara O'Toole and Tom Inglesby and the DA Henderson leave the John Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies to create the UPMC Center for Biosecurity. That's, again, one of those private contractors. And then three separate SARS releases from high containment facilities in Asia kill one researcher's mother and infect several hospital personnel. And then the Sunshine Project launches a thorough survey of the Institutional Biosafety Committee and guideline systems administered by the National Institute of Health. And the survey reveals widespread noncompliance with guidelines by institutions in all sectors. Governments are bad. Universities are bad. Everybody fails. And then Michael Carroll's Lab 257 chronicles the numerous safety breakdowns at Plum Island and suggests the facility may have accidentally introduced Lyme's disease and the West Nile virus into the United States. Nobody wanted to follow that up. Too bad, because I believe the research would have shown that. And then the you had 146 Massachusetts academics send a letter to the Boston City Council opposing Boston University's BLS-4 project. And then you had the Southern Research Institute mistakenly ships live anthrax samples to the Children's Hospital Oakland's Research Institute, and 49 mice injected with the anthrax unexpectedly die. Seven Oakland researchers are treated for antibiotics with antibiotics for the anthrax exposure. And three Boston University researchers are infected with tularemia. Boston University conceals the information and from the people until it's secretly given out. There's an article in Science, quote, tiptoeing around Pandora's box raises concerns about experimental effects of the bird flu virus that they actually wanted to make different. And then Fort Detrick announces plans for a massive new national interagency biodefense campus. And it's doing this in broad daylight. Now it doesn't have to do everything in secret because no one cares. And the Republicans and the conservatives say right on. And the Democrats don't want to look like they're anti-national security. So they say, okay, so we have no one protecting us. Then the University of Medicine Dentistry of New Jersey in Newark loses track of live plague-infested mice. Gee whiz. Might have ended up in the... And then a Cincinnati-based test kit maker mistakenly ships H2N2 influenza, a 1957 flu which had killed 4 million people and had not circulated in the world since 1968, to 4,000 laboratories in 8 countries. And then Pandora's Box 5, a team from Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the CDC reconstruct or rescue the 1918 flu, which had killed at least 50 million people. That's what my guest was talking about. And they published the entire genome sequence in Nature. And they discovered, duh, that the 1918 flu is highly virulent. Gee whiz, how would we have known? It only killed 50 million people. And then Pharma Athenia, Emergent Biosolutions, and other biodefense firms form a lobbying group, the Alliance for Biosecurity, alongside the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and then Milton Leitenberg's Assessing the Biological Weapons and Bioterrorism Threat, published by the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College, systematically debunks claims by people like Tara O'Toole and former Senator Majority Leader William Frist that bioterrorism is the world's greatest existential threat. Leitenberg offers a detailed critique of the Atlantic Storm exercise conducted by the UPMC. And Nature reports that the CDC plans to mail the 1918 flu virus to a BSL-3 lab that requested it. And I have hundreds and hundreds of more of these. Texas A&M University, Robert Gates, our current, he was the former president down there. They resulted in the infection of a researcher by Brucella, and they don't report the infection. The CDC is mandated by the select agent regulations. And it goes on. So you want to know why I'm concerned? You bet I'm concerned, because they never tell us the truth. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.